Greetings everyone out there in webinar land. Today we're going to do webinar number 9 of 11. In fact, let me back up the screen here and show you the overall agenda. So you can see here a list of 11 webinars, and we're now at number 11 down here, number 9 down here. And 8 and 9 are sort of tied together. In 8, I talked about the big problem of, gee, my sales force doesn't want any changes at all. How do I migrate to new selling models? And got into some specific, you know, how do you look through a lot of different lenses to analyze your salespeople and figure a path forward for most of them to change things and move into an e-selling kind of a model innovation capability. And today, in number 9, I'm going to go, this is sort of step back, and we're looking at sort of the big sweep of you know, selling and channels and you know, why the model has become so fragile now. But not to worry, there are other channels that have gone before us that have had to deal with these kinds of changes and come up with the different models, and we can look at those and figure out how to adapt them. And then I'm going to basically leave you with a you know, a chance to, as you see here in the uses thing, to not just comfort zone the idea of changing, but to sort of actually give you some test cases where you go, oh wow, now you think about it, we do have to do something. I think we're at a point, you know, where the risk of not doing anything is much greater than the risk of trying something and moving forward. So let's move on here. Subtopics of, we're going to look a little bit at the origins of the model that most channels still have. That would be a, you know, time and territory commissionable sales rep, you know, who's running around and touting their, quote, relationships. We'll look at you know, sort of forerunner channels and what they did as far as, you know, model change. And then I'm going to go through a little section where I'm going to look at the pros and cons of the current compensation program, where overwhelmingly they're not good, and so it's begging for change. On the origins of the model, I mean, back in the musical The Music Man, which helped happen in River City, Iowa, actually it was Mason City, Iowa, 1912, basically the idea was factories were very local businesses. When they shipped stuff, it was horse and buggy. They wrapped things in craft paper and string. That was the packaging material of the time. And, you know, they decided to get ambitious and crank more volume and sort of push it, you know, out of the metro area or even into the next state. It's like, well, who's going to go, you know, be our advance person and make a market for us and tell everybody that this is available? And then, you know, we're going to sort of ship a, you know, big chunk, but people don't want to buy a big chunk. So maybe we need a local stocking agent. And this is how distributors started to evolve. And the idea was, okay, open up new territories. It's all going to be cold calling and green markets in a sense. We're just going to pay you 5% off the top because that's all we really can easily measure, and you get it, and we get it, and we understand it's an easy model. And go do it. And you will be the face of the company. It's not like we have a website and an internet and real time and email blasts and all that sort of stuff and instant, you know, video chat capability, et cetera. You know, you represent the company. And any questions, issues, problems, service, you're the person who's going to take care of that. You are, you know, really a very key person. And then point five, which is that, you know, when you go out there, it's basically a nation of little local businesses. And so you're going to have very easy access to, you know, the buyer who often is the owner. If the owner isn't doing the buying, they may say to the buyer, here's what I want to do. They're involved in the decision. And when you go out there, you know, you're sort of say, hey, I'm here. Here I am. And, you know, let me check your stock and I'll write up the orders and I'll mail them in. And, you know, because you were there and you got them going, they're loyal to you. So seniority was respected. And, you know, back in the old day, now kids don't respect it so much. And, you know, as the marketplace evolved and people became repeat buyers and competition had Me Too lines, you said, gee, I've got to keep doing my regular call basis to maintain the relationship and let them know I love them, et cetera. And if I miss a call, the competitor is going to be there on their regular call. And they may start to sort of nibble at my business. And, you know, most customers are going to say, well, I have to buy from at least two people, because then that allows me to check prices. If I don't, they're going to sort of maybe sneak prices up. So I've got to give some business to number two to keep them on the hook and coming back, so I can play that reverse auction price checking kind of game. And also, and if you're really big, you can have three, like a 50-30-20 split, and the guy who's getting 20% of a huge spend is still happy to be there. So you could have a three-way thing, and that would be sort of, you know, optimum max. And then, you know, we went through chronic sort of shortages and allocations. The last false one we had in the U.S. was 74-75. And with globalization, there's just sort of a chronic excess glut of equally excellent Six Sigma products. So it's just become sort of a commodity hell sort of world today. So anyway, those were sort of the original conditions that made sense. But then things started to change. Over time, on a life cycle of things, you know, I bought, the first time I ever bought it, I wasn't sure. Second time, I'm trying to remember details. But by the umpteenth time, it's like, hey, same old stuff. And gee, now I think about it, can I get this somewhere more efficiently, a little better total value? I'm going to sort of shop around. And in a digital world, we now can go to Amazon and type in a generic thing. I'm looking for a industrial size air conditioner. You know, so I'm not asking for a specific brand, and up pops, or I could put in an umpteen ton, you know, furnace, or a 50-gallon water heater, or, you know, some generic thing. And what's going to pop up is whoever bought the search words for that. And Amazon has aggressively been going to manufacturers around the world saying, if you are an outsourced producer of brand names in the U.S., you can take the number one selling SKU, put in a different wrapper, call it a different name, and you can have an instant brand access. When they type that in, boom, you're there, you know, with reviews and you know, a much lower price. And our global logistics infrastructure will take care of everything to the doorstep. So this is just the moats of having traditional channels and channel relationships. It's just evaporated. So now manufacturers are saying, gee, I'm the number one brand. I've got more, bigger, better, cooler distributors than most, you know, anybody else. But I'm not on Amazon. But now I maybe have to be there at least as a marketing awareness channel. And as soon as I start to put all sorts of stuff there from a digital engagement point of view, then people are going to want to answers to secondary, tertiary kinds of questions, deeper kind of questions, issues. And I can't really seamlessly say, oh, find a distributor near you and maybe they'll know what the answer is. I sort of maybe have to take care of them. So that starts to unweave and then necessarily reweave the channel model of what the manufacturer is now doing with for the end user and what is left for the distributor to do, or maybe what's new in a digital environment for the distributor to do. But this certainly isn't about the sales guy calling on a customer saying, hey, you know, I'm your pal, give me the order. And then, of course, millennials are taking over all the B2B, you know, buying positions, you know, rapidly over right now and over the next, you know, couple of years. And they prefer 24/7, 365 to shop around, get educated, and where there's radical product information, pricing, availability, alternatives, and tracking. So this is, you know, turning things into commodity hell for all of us. And it's like, hey, you're a nice guy, but here's where I can get this product faster, better, or for a lower price. Can you meet these standards? You know, and you're like, well, no, I can't, because our service cost bundle model includes reps from factories, me as an outside rep or inside rep, and this digital disruptor who's selling you, offering you the same me too item. They don't have any of those people. That's why they have a lower price. They say, well, that's great. I'll buy from them. And so this is, you know, becoming an ever bigger issue. At the bottom, there's a question. When was the best stage for reps to say, you know what, screw it, I'm going to go work for the competition because they, you know, for whatever reason, I think it's a better horse. They're going to pay me a little more. They're, you know, giving me a signing bonus, whatever. And presumably, I'm going to take my business with me. And it turns out in the industry life cycle of every channel, there was a sweet spot for jumping. It wasn't initially because, you know, initially, you know, you work for somebody who had an exclusive franchise. And, you know, you sell a lot of customers that exclusive franchise, and maybe it is, consistently a better brand from a quality point of view. So people are loyal to the brand, and you can't go to a competitor and say, well, they have a secondary kind of brand that isn't quite as good. The line isn't completely full, whatever. So you're kind of stuck selling your franchises, if you will. But as the rebuying occurs, as the Me Too brands catch up and knock off the number one brand, they all become equally excellent. And distributors are still, their mindset is still like, oh, the way we grow is we get more salespeople and we have more geographic territories and we call in more accounts. We're got a space here. Well, who's the existing sales guy there? Let's steal him from whoever he works for, kind of thing. That would be great. But you'd, in a metro marketplace, you would have to have, two or more sort of other independent distributors who'd want to bid on the rep services. What happens when private equity rolls up all the channels and you've gone from 8 distributors in a city of a given category of a product to 3? So maybe today there might be one other person that a rep might consider working for, and they go to him. It's not like the distributor's even coming after the sales guy, because everybody's got too many sales guys calling on too many accounts. And I've sat on a board where this is the case, where the reps for competitors have actually approached the company and said, hey, could I work for you? Because I've been taken over and they're consolidating, cutting costs, the service stinks and whatever. And the CEO has said, look, but these are the only accounts I can allow you to have. I'm not going to let you have your accounts that one of my sales guys calls on. And I'm not going to guarantee wages. I mean, from go, basically, if you're going to be straight commission, you eat what you kill, kind of thing. So it's like musical chairs. If there are 49 reps and there are 50 reps and 49 chairs, the odds of getting a chair are pretty good. But when it's three reps and 2 chairs, it's not so good. Also, the excess supply of equally excellent parity lines, which is still the case. Now there really is no fear of losing allocation reciprocity. I remember when I first got into a summer job working for a distributor back in the 70s, I said to a customer, or the customer said, we buy the majority of our stuff from you, your company, and we actually pay a higher price than we could from your competitors. And I said, well, really, why is that? And they said, well, because of this rep who calls on us. And I said, well, that's great. And what's special about the rep? And he said, well, during the last allocation, he went to work on your management to make sure we got extra allotment allocation, to keep our business running, because we were selling them something they needed to have to make everything go, type of thing. So I remember it was sort of irreverent. I said, oh, so it's like sort of protection money. Like, okay, I'll give you some more business and pay you a little bit more, but you owe me now. When next allocation, you're going to take care of me. And he goes, well, I don't like the term, but that was what it was sort of all about. And that was all he said. He didn't say he helps build my bottom line or run my business better. He's a consultant of some super value added kind of thing. He just said he's been here a long time and he seems to have some clout with your management during allocation periods. So, and also, back when, stealing was optimum, customers had not consolidated. Today, in many channels, the customer base is massively consolidated, and many of the bigger ones have consolidated their vendors. Sort of the integrated sole supply trend is well intact and continues to go. But that's a company-to-company sell contract relationship. It isn't, a rep with a personal rapport with a buyer. And now there still are small independent sort of creatures you could sell, and there could be an owner operator who's there and got long-time tenure, and you could build up a long-time relationship. But now the question is, do they give you enough margin dollars annually with a decent enough average margin dollar per transaction to be net profitable? And the answer is no. Actually, many with net profit analytics, you find out many of these customers, frankly, aren't profitable, and they don't have enough annual spend to support sort of, 8, 9, 10 calls a year to have a relationship. So much like the Fuller Brush Man or the Good Humor Man or the Encyclopedia People or the Avon Lady who used to call door to door, the economics got to the point where the potential to sell is too small and the alternate channels are too efficient. So that's a big issue too. The number of accounts that can actually support the increasing expense of face-to-face sale calling is shrinking. And there are more reasons for why the rep's cost of a call versus the value of delivering has declined for customers. Let's look at some of them. It used to be that if there was a product service issue, you would call the rep or wait for the rep and say, here's my problem. He'd say, all right, I'm all over it. But along came the quality trend and zero errors and 100% on-time delivery. And so, the amount of screw-ups that, firefighting, started to drop. Then database software for inside salespeople started arriving in the early 90s. So, why would I wait for a rep to ask a question? They'd say, I don't know, I'll go find out for you, as opposed to during working hours, I'll just call the inside salespeople, and they seem to have all the information at their fingertips. And since, well before 2000, the Institute of Supply Chain Management, they used to be called the National Association of Purchasing Managers or whatever, they would do a survey of big buyers, and I'm not even sure how much, you buy $1 million or more a year to be a big buyer, but they would say, all right, one of the questions was, what percent of the reps are worth seeing? And it pretty much sort of leveled out at 90% of the reps aren't worth seeing. Of course, 10% are. And it's a good question to say, what are the attributes of a 10%? And we all should do that for our best customers. And part of just being able to do it is just spending a lot more time preparing and following up on a sales call for best accounts. But more importantly, the database software thing, it's been eclipsed by the web. Now, basically, customers expect 24/7, 365, that they can get any answer they want anytime they want by just, clicking on a little icon on their screen and getting into their particular page at your website to find out whatever they want, as we do with Amazon. So that's really, in a sense, taken away a lot of the information service value that even inside sales reps used to have. And now the next level of need is sense-making, where basically a customer calls and says, I'm deep into the woods on a particular question or issue, and I've been to your website, I've been to the manufacturers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And these are the kinds of questions or issues I now have to make. And hopefully you're equipped to say, yes, I see you've gotten lost in the forest. Let me help you get to the other side where it's simple, elegance, and totally perfect for you and your context. So that would be sense making, where you have to have deep knowledge of both the customer and their context and deep knowledge of the solution or problem thing that they're looking for. A third sort of trend that's sort of eroding rep value, cost benefit, is net profit analytics. When you actually look at net profit and you realize, my gosh, there are very few, territories and therefore sales reps worth stealing. It's not uncommon, particularly in rural territories, to find that a rep might have actually one account or two that are okay net profitable. And the rest really are just small folks that can't afford the cost of sales force coverage, and yet it persists. Now, that said, there can be, territories where they are net profitable, and you, as a distributor, might want to say, for each one of my reps, what is sort of a final number? It isn't perfect. It won't be right, but it's going to be better than gut feel. What are the odds they would leave, and how much of the net profitable accounts could they switch? What is that number and that risk factor? And that's all in webinar number 8. Now, occasionally in some channels, there is big volume that goes to big customers on a brokerage basis. And it's really the distributor maybe just being mostly a credit shield. Now, if they're, if you're looking at blueprints and you're doing enormous amounts of hours to, quote some big, honking pipe valve fitting complex for a big chemical plant or, power system for a commercial building, as an electrical wholesaler, that's different. So there's a lot of value added there in the whole, configuration bidding process. But if it's just truckloads of packaging materials or, lumber or whatever, then, you may find, territories where they're net profitable and just leave them alone. And so that's fine. But statistically, there are not a lot of those. So again, you have to be situational. Point 4, millennials don't want regular rep calls. I mean, overwhelmingly and increasingly so. Then because they check online, they web room all of the biggest ticket, most shoppable items, give you last look. You can't meet them because you don't have the cost structure of a disruptor who stripped out all the people. And you've still got all the people sitting there with built into to the price, the margin that you have. I've already touched on the second last point there about factories' digital engagement imperative and how that's going to unweave and reweave the channel. And there's still going to be residual reasons distributors are going to exist and work with manufacturers. Most manufacturers cannot sell 100% of what they're doing direct, nor do they want to. And then lastly, you have to sort of ask yourself, how many veteran reps are willing to adapt to fit into new e-selling models? Now, in the background of why, you know, rep value, cost, whatever, erosion, all these things have been technological things. We sort of, it's like the air we breathe or fish are in water and they don't know it. But, you know, containers came along and reduced the cost of outsourcing manufacturing by 99%. So from 83 on, offshoring became a big thing. Now, you know, now maybe we're going to have some reshoring into automated factories. You know, be curious to see how that goes. Then barcodes came in, and that basically triggered an entire retail distributor consolidation in the 80s, you know, and the drug wholesale, the grocery wholesale, the hardware wholesale, et cetera. And in those situations where the retail channels flipped and basically went to sort of an integrated sole supply kind of thing and bigger and bigger consolidators doing business with bigger and bigger consolidated wholesalers, the number of territory, time and territory, call on, you know, businesses in your area, reps collapsed by 90%. So in other words, about 10% of them made them to the new world over a 10-year period of time. As you know, now what happened, instead of calling every Tuesday, you'd call maybe four times a year. And because you had 100% of the business, you're really there to help these businesses grow their business. How can we help you grow your business and profitably so? So you have to buy more stuff from us and have the free cash flow to pay your bills on time. So it was sort of enlightened self-interest consulting kind of thing that went on there. And I'll come back and talk a little bit about Walmart's cross-docking and because it was going on in parallel here. And then the next big thing is the iPhone, which is our remote to life and, you know, ever-increasing bandwidth and global position satellite costs collapsing and so forth. So it's created this huge data into the cloud, machine learning, you know, personalization of what's going on, artificial intelligence, which we, you know, interfere. You do Waze or, you know, any applications you're doing, your web, there's artificial intelligence behind that. So the idea that we're going to wait to see a rep and say, here are my problems. Oh, good. Let me make a note. I'll get back to you. That's just not going to happen. We want instant answers right now. And then the last thing is basically Flex Corporation, you know, basically takes care of you. Cisco, you know, for example, huge, you know, the internet company, you know, the routers, all that sort of stuff, they don't make anything. It's 100% outsourced, and Flex Corporation takes care of that. Amazon has picked up a big inbound supply chain thing for Volkswagen, for example. They are not going to want to go after outbound because that's where they really, you know, they got their own infrastructure there, but you're going to see more and more supply chains going into the artificial intelligence-driven cloud. And these are other technologies that are ever you hear about, but the interesting thing is Amazon is investing top-down in all of these things and really is the leading living edge of most of this stuff. And so don't be surprised as their end-to-end value chain, starting with you and me and our screen of our choice or voice commerce, hi Alexa, go buy me whatever, is not going to continue to get, you know, fleshed out and ever more robust and capable and threatening as far as nibbling away at different SKUs and types of scenario buying and so forth from traditional B2B channels. Now, we're going to step back here and we're moving to the next section, which is as we look at the history of selling models in the past, what are some industries, verticals where they've said, you know what, times have changed and we need to change the model. So a big one for the insurance industry back in the late 20s was to split cold calls from rebuys. So hunters and farmers. So the hunters, all they did was go after new business. They got paid a lot of money, a high base, plus, you know, shoot, whatever you get, you know, we're going to give you a generous commission, because you're going to take a lot of cold call rejection, and there's probably going to be a lot of turnover if we don't give you a high guaranteed wage and, you know, a big incentive to find people that really want to go out there and kill and love it and can take rejection all day long. But once we have a customer, we're basically going to put an inside sales, reactive, what can I do for you, maintainer on this thing. And then statistically, supply and demand, there are a lot more people say, you know what, I want a 9-to-5 job where I don't take any rejection. The customer calls me as opposed to I call them, and I take care of their issues and so forth. So we're going to give you a very low, a much lower salary, you know, much less rejection, if any, and the turnover is going to be very low, and we'll give you a little, you know, sort of a bonus based on some target or something. Well, here's what most distribution channels did. They just kept the 5% of off the, you know, sales, or 20-25% of margin dollars, which works out to be 5% of sales, for both the new business and rebuys. So as the rebuys rise to 85, 90, 92, 93, 4% of everything you're selling is basically something the customer's bought before. They know what the brand is. They can buy the same damn brand from even another competitor. Now we're talking about a commodity rebuy, and we're paying 5%. So, of course, this is a low-stress job. Great. I'm not taking any turnover, and I'm getting paid a lot of money, and I get to do whatever I want to do, which is swell. So you look at a lot of distribution sales force guys, and, you know, you're seeing guys that, you know, average age is, you know, late 50s. They've all been in the company 20, 30 years. There's no turnover, and once, you know, they age, it's, you know, they start to just, frankly, you know, coast on out. So this is a big problem, because if you have a bunch of veterans sit in on a bunch of the existing big accounts, it's hard to recruit new talent and say, we'll give you access to any kind of accounts because all the best ones are already assigned to people that have got tenure. And then along comes web rooming, which exposes the cost of the rep to the biggest customers. I mean, I when CEO went out to call in his single biggest, largest, most net profitable account, and he, you know, walked right in and talked to the VP of supply chain because he's the CEO, and he didn't think any of it. And this, you know, the VP said, "Oh, well, you know, professional courtesy. I don't talk to salespeople." "Oh, really? Well, who talks to salespeople?" "Oh, we have a person where we have a title on their thing saying director of purchasing or something. They're just the replenishment clerk, and they see all salespeople four times a year." So it turns out that his sales rep was calling on the replenishment clerk thinking that was the director of purchasing, and, you know, only four times a year, and the rep was getting $16,000 in commissions off the account. So for $4,000, you know, in commission per call on the wrong person to have a courtesy call because they had already decided to marry the distributor, you know, had gotten very involved in inside salespeople. Now, you know, a lot of people have gotten involved in creating this system relationship over time. Well, that at some point, customers wake up, and I'll point that out, and notably in the Walmart case in 1991. And then as the retail channel shifted to sole supply, where they said, you know what, we're going to backward integrate in our own distribution, the 80s, what happened? Well, first of all, personal selling to independents went to team-to-team system selling to the consolidator. So in 1980, it was VHS rental, rent tapes. You know, you go into any little store and you had a little rack of VHS tapes you could rent to watch movies on your new VHS recorder player. And so that whole industry, you know, it grew up and consolidated in about 10 years. So if you're the rep who happens to be in the geography where Blockbuster's headquarters happen to be in South Florida, and now they control 50, 60, 70% of the national market, do you think that Blockbuster wants to buy from a sales rep and it's because they like the sales guy, et cetera? Or do they want to call up some national distributor saying, hey, we're huge, you're huge, what's the deal type of thing? So when you go from a nation of shopkeepers to huge consolidation and the consolidators want to buy on a special deal basis from the consolidated wholesalers, it's a different story. So many of them basically moved to an unbundled 3PL a la carte services for fee kind of model. I mean, in the case of McDonald's, basically it's, okay, here it's all open book. So both McDonald's and the suppliers or the tomatoes or whatever can check Martin Brower's, you know, P&L. They can do an audit and make sure that 100% of special prices or any kind of terms are being passed through completely to McDonald's. McDonald's also wants to make sure that's going on, and McDonald's guarantees them a generous return on investment. So they say, we will give you a guaranteed operating profit because we want you to have a lot of incentive to continue to reinvest that money in your business to grow it. So Martin Marauder's gone from $2 million to $15 billion since 1956 without any outside capital. And you know, and also, we now will continue to move down the mutual cost curve together. So we have to keep coming up with innovations to make this an ever better, slicker, more phenomenal supply chain, lowering the distributor's cost to serve so they can lower the price. And over, you know, from 1956, you know, margins might be have been like 25% out of the warehouse with a cost to serve of maybe 20%. So there's a 5% operating profit. Today, it's around 5% of the warehouse. Cost to serve is about 4%. So there's a 1% operating profit. But asset turns have gone from maybe 12 in 1956 to, you know, 80 or more today. So although the margin percent's small, the asset base shrunk even more. So the return on investment is still very high, very generous, and allows Martin Brower to continue to invest in next generation warehouses and automation and so forth. So basically, if you can say, hey, I've got such good cost to serve elements like a 3PL, you tell me what you want, and I'll give it to you. You know, we'll custom a la carte figure out exactly what you want, and here will be the prices of the contract. That is customer centric, as opposed to no, you don't get any choice. You happen to get the sales guy that owns the geography where you happen to be one, and if they're good or bad or whatever, that's just the way it is. And then we have this standard service cost bundle, and that's the way it's going to be. You don't get to, you know, have any special deals and so forth, except maybe, you know, special prices, you know, but that's about it. Also, I skipped over, actually, SuperValu. I was so impressed. I was doing something for the Grocery Channel back in 1986. I was visiting with the president of SuperValu's service division. And by 1986, the wholesale grocery industry had gone from maybe 2,000-plus wholesale grocers, distributors, in 1960 to, you know, maybe five that mattered in 1986. And as SuperValu was the king at the time, they had evolved 185 different services, all for fees. They actually had a catalog, and they had the division of their own P&L. And then there was the logistics division, which basically sold food as sort of an open book cost plus and the cost of the trucks. And so the logistics division would come to the president of the service division and say, look, we have a chance to pick up a chain of 13 grocery stores, but they want these services for free. And the service division guys say, no can do. I can give them to them for free, and I'll bill you for what, you know, what I would normally charge a grocery, you know, client. They said, well, that'll hurt our bottom line. They said, well, that's too bad. So by splitting the services and the food, the volume, and keeping them honest, that's the way they did it. And heretofore, you know, distributors typically are not very good at selling services for fees. We have freight. Well, I'll waive that. These are our terms for trade credit. Well, you can go there 30 days. Don't worry about it. Well, you know, we'll put in just-in-case stock. Basically, if I pay my salespeople on strictly margin dollars, I am paying them to try to give away all services, you know, free returns, free anything, because it helps me to make more money and get and keep more sales and margin dollars. I don't, as a rep, I really don't see, can't care about cost to serve. And so that's a you know, fundamental issue you've got to deal with. So this is a structural way that SuperValu took care of that problem in the mid-80s. Walmart's parallel story, 1961, the Supreme Court struck down fair trade laws, which allowed people like Eastman Kodak to say all retailers must sell our film at the same, you know, list price. You can't discount. So three companies, Kmart, Walmart, and Target, all started up in 1962. Kmart was a spin out of the, you know, SS Kresge five and dime kind of a business. Target was a spin out of Dayton Hudson. And Walmart, Sam just closed down his Walmart, you know, his Ben Franklin stores and opened up his first Walmart, which was a smaller version clone knockoff of the first Kmart stores. And basically, they were all saying, we now can sell big brands for less. We're discounters of brand names. Then in between 83 and 86, Walmart pioneered cross-docking with the textile industry. And then from 86 to 88, they went work with Procter & Gamble, and Procter & Gamble sent 60 people on average down to Bentonville, Arkansas for 2 years to figure out how to rewire everything so that the P&G stuff would flow through these 9-acre, lights-out, you know, monster, you know, cross-docking distribution centers. Where cases come whipping off, you know, a supplier truck at 37 miles an hour with all the right barcodes and laser beams are flashing, and they go whipping through 8 miles of track to outbound Walmart, you know, store delivery trucks. And so every store gets, you know, 1, 2, 3 full trailer loads of stuff from these distribution centers. And a distribution center takes care of about 150 Walmart stores. So in 1988, the Newell Corporation said, you know, Walmart has created a whole new supply chain innovation killer capability. We think they're going to put all these other little regional discounters out of business. So why should we call on little regional guys who are going to be put out of business when Walmart grows as much as one of these retailers, these regional discounters in 1 year? So they actually built a facility in Bentonville and put in all the racks just the way they were in Walmart stores. They bring Walmart buyers over and say, look, here are the categories we sell into. We've spray painted what we sell versus, well, who are all these other guys? And they figured out how to repackage in the right size boxes and so forth with the right barcodes to go through your cross-docking center. And they said, well, no, they haven't. So Newell would start to buy these guys, Newellize them, so they could then run that stuff through the cross-docking DCs. And together, Newell and Walmart co-invented something called category management, where they put Newell in charge of getting to, you know, say what if they didn't buy from Newell, what vendors should they buy from? And then Newell would tell those vendors how to do, you know, deal with Walmart better to just basically take out costs from the channel and have higher fill rates every day on the shelves. Well, then, you know, everybody started to mimic Newell, and these little facilities became embassies. And there are over 200 embassies in Bentonville. It's called Vendorville, because you know when you have somebody that's big, you're gonna invest more upfront and early to partner them, because then they're going to grow you. That's called marrying, partnering the gazelle. And I'll come back to that theme periodically through all my webinars. Well, then in November of 91. Walmart sent out an infamous memo to all these suppliers and said, you know, you guys have got these factory reps that, you know, got the state of Arkansas, and you pay them 3%, 5%, 15%, you know, depending on how small or big the volume is. You're paying them a percent, you know, percent off the top of everything sold in the state of Arkansas. And because a freak of nature with centralized buying has exploded here, these guys are making $300,000, $1 million a year, and they're showing up every day in our lobby with donuts saying, can I help? And the answer is no, they can't. So we want you to lose the rep. And instead, we want a different kind of selling interaction, a different selling model, if you will. We want a honcho-led team, and the honcho must understand supply chain and have the power to say yes and write checks. We don't want any messenger people. And all we're going to do is work on our existing cross-docking capability, ever the next generation barcodes, et cetera. It's just an ongoing path of innovation that we found, and all of our competitors don't get it. And this is what we want. And if you don't, you know, heed our request, then we'll just discount what we think the factory rep's commission is off our invoices. So basically, the customer rebelled. They said, we don't want this ancient selling model, and we're paying these guys way too much for something they can't do. We need something different. So you may find that, you know, some of your customers may de facto basically say, well, look, you know, I can shop around or whatever, and I've decided that I can get a better deal from someone else with a different kind of selling model and a cost value price structure. Just parenthetically today, Supercenter, Walmart Supercenter is about 120,000 SKUs. 7,000 of them are 70% of their sales. All of those items mandatorily go through the cross-docking. Because of cross-docking, they're able to have 99% fill rates with no excess inventory and everyday low prices. That is the core of the Walmart offering. And only Target, you know, of all the other discounters that used to exist, has figured out how to finally mimic this cross-docking capability. Kmart, you know, woke up 5 years too late and then bungled their effort to try to do it. And by the way, Walmart doesn't do any promotions at all. They say, you know, to do a promotion, you know, is to get people to buy what's on sale as opposed to the brand. And then they buy 6 weeks supply and they don't buy it over the next 6 weeks. So it upsets our just-in-time everyday flow of stuff. So we would rather have steady flow at everyday low prices and promote the brand as opposed to, you know, try to conditioning customers to buy whatever, buy price and whatever's on sale. So a question I guess you have to ask is, of all the distributors out there, what percent of honchos sort of see how things are changing, can accept it, and then say, you know what, let's start failing forward to make it happen and have the courage to start acting and executing and moving towards a new paradigm. And you don't have to be perfect. All you have to do is be better than all your competitors who don't want to see it, don't want to accept it, and don't want to change. This particular one is on the ongoing theme of integrated sole supply and B2B channels. You know, SAP started moving into big, complicated manufacturing plants, you know, here in the United States, sort of like circa late 80s, 1990. And it was so expensive to implement. And, you know, people started to have questions about, well, where are the benefits of SAP, you know, on our new company here? Or, you know, it's like root canal and where huge costs, where are the benefits? And one thing was, well, they have central spend management, so we can see what all the spend is going on at our different factories. And, oh, wow, yeah, okay, well, let's go find some vendor who has a footprint that can cover our where all of our plants are and say, here's how we want to buy on a consolidated, integrated, very highly visible, manageable, measurable kind of way. So the integrated sole supply for MRO kind of stuff to factories really started to take off. They already, in SAP, the core of it was OEM. In other words, you know, the ingredients that a manufacturing plant is buying that goes into what they're making, that was already part and parcel of the SAP system. But they said, we can actually apply this also to maintenance, repair, and operating stuff. Like, oh, okay, cool. So that started taking off. And then I want to think it was around 1996, I remember reaching a Fortune magazine about Jack Welch at GE extolling how they had put in this integrated sole supply thing and saved all this money. And so then every CEO said, hey, what are we doing for integrated supply? And thereabouts, Grainger said, okay, we're going to jump in big time and try to be say, call us, we will come in and we will design the whole integrated supply and, you know, and make sure that all the stuff, you know, whether it comes from us or someone else flows to and through you, whatever. And they persisted with it and, you know, and finally got out of it in 2005. It's another story. But the point is that it really sort of took off big time there. And in that environment, you know, you're going to still have salespeople, but they're out there trying to find people who want to go with an integrated supply deal. And once that's, you know, consummated, you know, they're going to get their incentive, but nothing thereafter. Then the team takes over and installs it, maintains it, measures it, and all that sort of stuff. There's no residual, you know, thing because the hunters, it doesn't have a value-added part in that new that ongoing story. The whole hospital supply channel flipped to integrated sole supply roughly between 1996 and 2000. Health maintenance organizations got going in California in the early 90s, and all the hospitals freaked out and started consolidating like crazy, and then they turned around in turn and, you know, just to try to save money because HMOs were beating them up so badly, you know, started going to sole integrated supply contracts. And really over, you know, arguably beginning to end, maybe 10 years, but the fat part of the matter was, you know, 4 or 5 years there in the late 90s, you know, over 100 regional distributors consolidated into four national footprint sellers. You know, McKesson, Cardinal Health, and so forth all have huge medical distribution capability, and they're basically doing system selling. allegiance. You know, there used to be American Hospital Supply. It was bought by Baxter. Baxter spun it out around 1996. They called it Allegiance, and they did one of the most amazing turnaround renewals and reinventions in about a 3-4 year period that you could imagine. Spare you the details. But to really basically go out and meet this need, the hospital saying, we want to buy from One Soul Integrated Supply, they literally bought consulting firms that specialized in process system work for hospitals and turned those guys into their sales force. So I don't have any stats on what percent of the traditional product pushing, regular calling, rep territory kind of selling relationship guys got wiped out, or what percent were able to morph themselves into consultants, you know, dealing with, you know, big consolidated hospitals on a big consolidated integrated supply contract. But it was unnecessarily small. I think, again, if you can see how the world is changing and what you have to do, you increase the odds that more and more people can be part of that solution. I mean, it's going to take a lot of education, and that's why we're doing these webinars, but it's, you know, we can upskill a lot more people. And I asked the question at the bottom of the slide, which is, why aren't all distributors able to potentially flexibly sell systems? Now, along a continuum, I mean, you know, there could be accounts where they say, oh, here's, you know, a huge long list of fancy, cool stuff we want to do. And you say, you know what, we're just not there. But really, on a 2080 basis, you know, should be able to be, you know, fluent and flexible with this whole concept of selling a holistic high-performance system, as opposed to, can I sell you a product today or shoot you some prices on cases of whatever? And not that all of your customers would want to get it or could do it, but certainly, you know, your best local, most open-minded, progressive, innovative, let's call those gazelles, about 3% of your customers would be receptive to it. So why not do it proactively, as opposed to waiting for them to tell you this is the new way and it's just too little and you can't oblige. Flexible rep selling along this continuum I just mentioned. You know, you could have somebody who's said, well, what's your price? That's all that matters. Okay, well, the price really depends. You know, if you have a bigger order, it's going to be a better deal than if you have a smaller order, because order size economics matters. You know, to stop the truck and fool around paperwork and take an order, these are kind of fixed, actionable activity costs, and we have to more margin dollar in the order. So here's a little calculator, and build your own quote, if you will. And they start to educate themselves, like, oh, so – you know, I really, like, if I'm going to the grocery store and I don't want to go, you know, every day, which is time and driving and parking and whatever, maybe just once a week, and consolidate all that shopping time and driving time, whatever, I need to have a disciplined replenishment system, and I need to have a grocery list to make sure I get all the things I need. And then by entering the mall, then I get a better deal. If you are a rep calling on a buyer who says, you know, is that the best you can do? Hopefully an agile rep would say, hey, no, we can always give you a better price, but, you know, it depends on the terms. In other words, if you want to give me more volume and or, you know, a larger average order size to help me lower my cost to serve as a percent of sales, then I have room to give you a price. That failing, you know, thank you for last look, but, you know, I want last look in 2 points. Because, you know, I want 1 point for me, because let me remind you all the things I've done to make you look good, save your rear end, you know, put money in your bottom line, and I want a fraction of the incremental action I've created for you, so I want an extra point, and I want an extra point for my horse, because my horse is the best service excellence, you know, beast out there, and we, you know, got the best fill rate stuff, on time, you know, type of thing, and you'd explain to them why this lowers their total procurement cost. So yes, my price is a little higher, but it's still the best total value. Now that would be pure salesmanship of, you know, a total value proposition, if you have one. But still, if you, you know, that, and this, well, okay, I get that, but I get measured on price savings. Okay, fine. Here's how we're gonna make you look like a hero. You know, it's price judo, it's quid pro quo. You know, basically you name the price and we'll come in and name the terms. And if you want my team to come in, you know, and do an audit of how you, we've got data, Shane, statistically, how you're buying, where the friction is and whatever, we can make you a proposal that will lower some or all the elements of total procurement costs, including price, make you look like a hero type of thing. Do you want my audit team to come in? So that would be the beginning of moving a customer sort of from the lower left-hand corner of this chart up to the northeast corner where McDonald's has been a star for 67 years and counting. And basically McDonald's up there at 6'6", they both have a win-win philosophy. We want to win, but we want our suppliers to win because that allows the relationship to continue and continue to innovate and move down the mutual cost curve on a win-win basis. And we are very, very savvy on the vertical axis about, you know, total holistic economics. And we don't want, you know, unnecessary hidden soft costs. We're going to measure those, know those, and whatever. And so you could plot customers on this sort of grid and say, where are they? And how many are you know, teachable? How can we help proactively help customers move towards the northeast corner and be better buyers and on a win-win basis? I talk about this in other webinars, so I'm going to just stop there. But down at the bottom right-hand corner, you can see the little yellow box there where it says YT. That stands for YouTube down here. If you go to YouTube and you search for Bruce Merrifield plus playlists, you'll get there, and there are 9 different playlists that have, I don't know, over 430 different video clips, averaging about 4 minutes each. But on playlist 9, for clips 14, 15, 16, 17, I talk all about this and case studies and history and all that sort of stuff. Okay, now, well, let's just take a step back and say, well, Bruce, geez, you know, maybe all I need is a new incentive plan. What's the new incentive plan that I can put in effect that's going to make my salespeople magically transform into something else? The answer is it doesn't exist. On the left-hand side, I have what I call my kinetic chain. And again, if you go to Google and you type in my last name plus kinetic chain in quotes, the video clips, the art articles and stuff will pop up to explain all 7 steps. But you got to start with who's in charge, who's running the show, the leader, the champion, whatever, strategy, culture, systems, et cetera. So if I put in a new incentive, but I'm a dysfunctional leader, I have an unfocused, crummy strategy, dysfunctional culture, I have dysfunctional systems, aptitude. I don't really have a sales guy that, you know, works for sticks or carrots. They just kind of do what they do, and they're there. And if I put in a new incentive because I want them to change their behavior, well, they need new skills and new tools. So actually, incentives is the cherry on top. We need to basically rethink, check all of these steps and make sure they're all internally consistent and aligned and supportive of, and then if it's appropriate to have a new incentive, we'd put that in place. So there's not a simple silver bullet incentive plan you can put in place. Then on the right-hand side, you can, you know, Google the Kuhn cycle and read about it. But basically it just says people come up with theories. The earth is flat. And, you know, everybody uses that, you know, for their assumptions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then people start to notice stuff that sort of suggests that maybe the earth isn't flat. And at some point the evidence is so overwhelming, it collapses. They say, oh, no, the earth is round. And the earth is not, you know, the center of the heavens is actually the third rock from a mediocre star that we call the sun, you know, type of thing. So he used it in a scientific sense, but we can now apply it to standard commission plans. So if you pay your salespeople some sort of, you know, percent of margin dollar, yeah, you can trick it up and you can go, oh, we pay you a little more and higher margin percent and, you know, whatever. But basically, you're just paying them kind of a constant number of the margin dollars. The wonder overall pro is it's simple and it's been here forever. Don't mess with Mother Nature. Then if you said, well, on the other, in a balance scale, that's a positive. Let's put that over here on the positive side. On the negative side, let's put some of the cons. So for example, if 80-95% of what you're selling have become commodities, then we may be paying salespeople a lot of money for very little value added at our largest accounts, who are maybe saying, maybe it's time to go to integrated sole supply and, you know, why can I find better prices online and so forth. The second trend is rep avoidance. You know, or as you saw a survey earlier where big buyers said 90% of sales reps are not worth seeing. Well, millennials, you know, overwhelmingly don't want to see reps on a regular basis. They only want to talk to humans when they're lost in the woods and they need, you know, some e-selling support, like 24/7, 365, who can I talk to and share a screen with or whatever? Or if I need somebody to come out, you know, and make a presentation, that's fine. But I don't need to see people every Tuesday with donuts just in case I want to see them and give them some things to do or whatever. So that's climbing. The farmers, in other words, if people basically just do their what they've been doing, they've been doing it for so long that they're in a rut, and they haven't really done anything new or exciting except just keep showing up. Game of attrition. If I just hang in there, maybe the competition, you know, collapses or retires or dies, maybe I'll pick some more up. They're not going to go out and say to a customer, look, you know, yeah, I can give you a lower price, but you're going to have to change the way you buy. You're going to have to buy more from us. You're going to have to buy in larger average order size, which means you have to rethink your internal discipline systems and replenishment, you know, type of thing. They're going, well, I'm just a buyer in a silo, and I just get measured on price. Can't you just give me a price, you know, make me look like a hero? Okay, yeah, let me see if I can give you a price discount. I'll go beat up my boss to give you something. You know, that's so. If you have salespeople who haven't done anything new in the last 5 years, the odds they're going to do something new in the next 5 years is probably zero. So how do we become challengers? We're saying, hey, we're out here to build your bottom line. And one of the ways to build your bottom line is to, you know, take a step back and look at your whole replenishment system and find unnecessary friction in it and remove that. If you then want to, you know, reweave it, unweave it, reweave it, and transform it, we can do that. That would be a next level kind of thing. So, you know, that's a problem. Four, what accounts you inherited, because most businesses are mature businesses, and this isn't first generation salesmen going on doing all cold calling, what accounts you inherit become annuities, and when you come of age or get hired and what accounts become available, it's just sort of random luck timing and or politics. In other words, if you suck up to the sales manager and some guy drops dead, new accounts become available, who gets the juicy annuity accounts and who doesn't? Well, you know, you're part of my little club, maybe I'll throw you a few juicy bones here type of thing. So that's honestly what's going on. Point five, we pay the same for harvesting. In other words, you've got an account, we're going to pay you X percent of what's coming in. And if you want to go slower and, you know, get addled and new buyers come in and they're younger and they don't like you and but that's all right. You can just milk that territory right into the ground as opposed to, and we pay the same for get off your butt, go out there and call an account that doesn't want to see you and figure out how to crack that on a new net profitable basis. That's 10 times harder, but we pay the same. So everybody says, well, then I'm just going to bird the hand is worth, you know, 10 in the bush. I'm just going to, you know, hang on to this and spend 100% of my time maintaining as best I can. We pay number six. We pay the same for net profitable and unprofitable accounts. If you just pay in margin dollars, you're not lucky in a cost to serve. So if you've got two accounts that both give you 100 grand in sales, both 25,000 in margin, and one guy gives you 100 orders a year and the other gives you 1,000 orders a year, 10 times the transactional activity, you're not making the same money on the high order, you know, small order, you know, account. And probably the cost to serve of all those small orders exceeds the margin dollars you actually lose money. So that's a problem. How are we going to solve that? And then it becomes very tough to reassign viable accounts from, you know, older guys to younger guys. And so how do we, you know, continue to have, you know, new blood coming into the company? The compensation per call on the biggest, best customers will be exposed because of internet information. You'll see more and more Walmart responses where they're basically saying, wait a minute, we don't want this. We're going to speak up. We're not going to, you know, wait for you to proactively pitch us. We're going to proactively pitch you on, we need a different kind of selling relationship here. And that's what, when a customer says, I want to integrate Sole Supply, that's what they're saying. And to realize the paying sales guys on a straight commission actually isn't customer centric. In theory, you would let the customer be the final arbiter of, do I want a rep? How often do I want to see him? What do I want to do? And how much is that going to cost me? Just like when I hire a lawyer or accountant or any professional service person, they don't bill me an annual amount of money just in case I might want to use them. You know, they say, well, you know, tell me what you want and I'll quote you a price. So maybe you would go putting reps on salary. And then, you know, incentives would vary literally down to the account level in some cases. Number nine, millennial B2B buyers want e-selling support on a 24/7 real-time basis, as opposed to, hey, you know, call me every Tuesday and we'll have a chat about what I might need and so forth. And to provide that kind of 24/7 support would be a bit of a team challenge. I mean, to have one guy there all the time might be a little bit more difficult. And then number 10, the manufacturers are to have digital engagement strategies, which is going to start to ripple through the channel and change the channel model. So you've got three, as a distributor, you have three different model innovations. You can rethink your selling models. You can rethink your business model. That would be a 3PL unbundled service for fee, you know, flexibility type of thing. And then with your manufacturers, you're going to have to rethink what you do and what you don't do and how you get paid for that and whatever, your channel model. So, and then finally, number 11, it's not got a number, but straight commission basically resists all changes. I can't, I say, hey, you can do blah, 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 you can do this and whatever. And people, oh no, my sales force wouldn't stand for it. Time out. Here, this just basically says, what's the annual margin dollars you have to get from an account to fund, support a, quote, outside sales, field sales call relationship? And assuming that, you know, a sales guy makes 4 or 5, you know, calls per day, and what's the total cost of your average sales guy, Social Security, health benefits, all in, you're going to come up with a cost north of $100 per FaceTime call. And then if you're going to pay something on margin dollars, let's say you want to pay 20, 25% of the margin dollars, and you need 10 calls per year to be a friend, a consultant, have a real relationship, then that means you're going to have $1,000 in for the cost of the calls. And you might want your call cost to be 20% of the total gross margin dollars. You would need $5,000 in margin minimum to support that, quote, relationship call frequency. And then if you wanted that $5,000 to be profitable, the average margin dollar per transaction would ideally be, you know, let's say at least $150 and up to $250 would be very net profitable. If the average margin dollar per order is $100 and you've got a salesman on the account, they're unprofitable. So you apply those constraints to how many accounts do we actually have right now that can support outside salespeople, you'll find that most distributors have too many reps, in a sense, making too many calls on too many customers that can't really support the relationship call. And that's why, you know, the typical distributor, when they do a customer profitability ranking report, find out, oh my gosh, you know, somewhere between 40 to 80% of my accounts are net unprofitable. So that's something to deal with. Another thought exercise is, you know, unbundling the rep. If every supplier offered you, think thought experiment, the status quo, we're going to just keep doing what we're doing, or what we're going to do is we're going to take our field salespeople off your account. And actually, the total cost for field sales runs 5% of the sales. So as long as you buy more than you bought the year before, equal to or more than the year before, we'll give you every quarter a 5% rebate on what you bought the previous quarter, because you were able to buy the same stuff without the help of the sales guy. However, if you want to see, you know, a number 10 superstar sales rep call be out here, we can quote you that on an unbundled for fee basis. So then the question is, oh, well, how many, you know, vendors do you have as a distributor say, oh, don't change it, because, you know, the fact that there's a build-in cost of 5% for your rep field, they're worth 8 or 9 or 10% because that's how much they're building my bottom line. And actually, not to start any food fights or anything, but, you know, most distributors, CEO, you know, gatherings, I'll ask this question, you know, they think about it, they say, well, maybe 10% of my vendors, you know, I would want to continue to see the sales rep, not that they don't get promoted real quickly and I might change my opinion on that vendor. But it's sort of consistent with that big buyer survey where 90% of the people that call on me, they're kind of a waste of time. I really don't need to see them. And gosh, if I could get that money, I'd take it type of thing. And then another situation is basically in the 80s, in the retail environment, when, you know, big wholesalers said, all right, look, you want a system sell? Fine, here's our system division. And an independent, grocery store, drug store, whatever, hardware store would say, well, wait a minute. You're telling me I can continue buying from the rep division, or I can buy from the system division. And the system division, I can buy everyday low prices of 8%. I'm going to switch to the system division. So when they were given a choice between buying on an unbundled basis, they basically, were forced economically, in a sense, to go for the everyday lower prices on a system basis. So, this, whether you like it or not, the radical information on the internet over the next couple of years is going to shake this old bundled service cost model, and you're going to have to deal with it. Conclusions, many accounts assigned to reps are unprofitable. They're too small. Selling model changes. How do we hive off minnows to a small account division? How do we fix big losers? In other words, we've got some accounts that are the big sales, big margin dollars, but intergalactically huge small dollar picks and orders, so the cost to serve exceeds the margin dollars. 3% of our very large accounts that are also profitable are also innovators, and they might be open to hey, if we came out here with an open book, cost plus type of thing, what can we co-create? And they said, well, this is very interesting. Let's talk about it. And it's not to say that there wouldn't still be some residual territories and it wouldn't be geographic, but it would residual territories where a lot of old school buyers who want to buy from a regular rep on a regular basis, and they're meeting $5,000 or more in margin and a decent average order size, and they can be profitable. So how do you sort of carve out some of those? Because, you want to be customer centric, and if that's the way some guys want to buy, let's honor that. If you have a profitable brokerage rep and they could switch their business, then don't mess. So here's the final test. From all the stuff I've just talked about, what happens when a customer buys a big, high-priced stock keeping unit online to avoid the markups? And an example would be, I was talking to a builder and he said, oh my gosh, my contractors are complaining that these very wealthy people are getting online and deciding what they want to buy, and they're buying it, and then they're asking the contractor to just quote them on labor. And the contractor's all upset because he really wants to put a markup on the stuff, and he wants to buy the particular thing he knows real well, and he can slam dunk put it in there. When he tries to create a magic act, fear, uncertainty, and doubt, saying, well, I can't guarantee it. This is, whatever type of thing. But basically what's going on is customers are going to start to see shop. It's web rooming. It's like going to Best Buy and figuring out exactly what you want and then checking on Amazon and realizing you can buy it for 20% less or whatever, and you hit the button and buy from Amazon. You've stripped that Best Buy of all their, retail location, their inventory, their floor people, et cetera, and you shop the price. So you're going to find that that's going to happen more and more. And when somebody says, here's the meat of the matter, here's the most profitable big ticket stock keeping unit that you have to sell, and I can buy it for less somewhere else, here's last look. You really can't, you can't meet the price because you need, the 3% of your items that are massively profitable, that's your cream items. They pay for all your losing items. They pay for your losing customers. Your service cost standard model, is going to get shaken to the ground. A second scenario would be more and more manufacturers basically put on configure your own, piece of equipment. It's called configure price quote. But this can also be applied to build your own order. In other words, the more line items you have, the fatter those line items are in quantity, the more margin dollars there is per line item, the more margin dollars there is per order, then you start to get overall discounts. Maybe initially you earn your way to getting free freight, then you start getting a discount on the overall order. So that sort of teaches the customer how to buy. And I'll just leave you with this sort of trend. I mean, cars are more complicated than most of the products that distributors sell. And in 1999, 40% of the average auto dealer's profits came from selling new cars. Today, it's between 0 and 10% because people can get online, go to Edmunds, zero in on exactly what they want, do deep dives, et cetera, go to the auto dealer, strip them of a free test drive. Then they can go to Auto Trader, these reverse auction sites, and say, hey, I want to buy a midsize Audi SUV, you know, Q5 with the bigger engine, 3.0, navy blue. All you Audi dealers out there, does anybody want to bid on this? Maybe 2, 3, 4 guys bid on it, you know, and the guy that wins isn't really going to make any money. So, and now factory, you know, the auto factories are, you know, experimenting with, you know, configure price quote software in small countries, like think Norway, 4 million people, as opposed to Britain, where there are, you know, 70 or 80 million people. They don't want to upset their dealers just yet. But basically, if people can get on there and figure what they want, and then the idea of the quote is, well, you call up and say, look, I've got this, here's the price, but what are the extra little terms? If I can wait, you know, a few more weeks, can I get a better deal? If I go pick it up somewhere, can I get a better deal? I mean, there are some variable terms there that would change the final all-in kind of price. Well, the factory's going to make that car to demand, and then why they could ship it direct, or they could ship it to the dealer for a little fulfillment handling fee. So you're going to find that manufacturers, if they do these digital engagement strategies, are going to start to upset the traditional economics of the channel. Not that there isn't going to still be a channel. It just has to be unwoven, rewoven. And the distributors that actually go to the suppliers and say, hey, let's figure this out together, are going to do better than the ones that try to resist and say that I'm going to resist all change. And then the last thing is, your biggest account says to you, hey, your competitor was in here and they came in and did an analysis and they gave me an open book 3PL solution. And, you know, this is really, you know, terrific. And I really like it a lot. So here it is. You know, do you want to counter this or give me something like this? Oh, we can't do that because really, do we understand it? We don't know our cost to serve. Our sales guy would really be upset. I'm a branch manager. I don't really have these other services I can provide. I don't even really know what I'm looking at. This is a different paradigm. I'm not equipped to really see it, understand it, embrace it, or execute on it. So do you want to wait till that happens, or do you want to get good at that and proactively sort of go out there and say, hey, we're ready when you are, and be a little bit more proactive with the, particularly the biggest, best, most progressive, open-minded, you know, customers. So bottom line, I hope that you will discuss these, live with the questions that I'm raising, and start to say, you know what, we need to anticipate, embrace, and start to test and experiment with these shifts, you know, or the risk of not doing anything is far greater than the risk of trying some of the stuff that Bruce might be recommending. So that's it. Sorry I overran a little bit today, but all the best. Thank you.